Hey gang, this episode of WTF is sponsored by Stamps.com. Go to Stamps.com and type in WTF when you click the radio microphone to start a no-risk trial and get a $110 bonus offer. That's Stamps.com. Enter WTF. Do it up.
Lock the gates!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fuckaholics, and what the fuck nicks? Let's leave it at that. I am Mark Maron. This is WTF. Welcome to the show. Thank you for listening. As always, it's morning time as I record this, which is unusual. So I have this urge to keep it down for some reason. Maybe I'm going to wake my neighbor or upset my girlfriend if I shout too loud from the garage. It'll go up into the vent system and my voice will just punch her in the head, but I don't know. I guess I'll figure that out after I'm done here. Today on the show, the scholar, I guess you would call him, or the curator, or the overseer, in-house scholar, publisher, Adam Parfrey is here. If you don't know who Adam Parfrey is, I will tell you in a minute. The man had an important effect on my life. I can't say it was all for the good, but he definitely had hold of my brain for a good few years, him and his work, his publications. Oh, my God, I'm just looking at the price of this book that I'm holding, an old book that Parfrey put out, the original and first Apocalypse Culture, which I've talked about on this show before. The price was $9.95. Look, let me just take a minute here to tell you what's going on at Comedy Central. If you haven't checked out the Jeselnik Offensive, I highly recommend you do so, even though he has not asked me to be on the show. And he's been on my show twice and is in my pilot. No, I'm not saying that never mind. Anthony, of course, is a friend of the WTF. He's been on, a couple episodes, and his show features a lot of the best people in stand-up comedy. This week, Jonah Ray and Jeff Ross are on the show. Doug Benson, Patton Oswalt, Aziz Ansari, Nick Kroll, and others have been on the show. Comedy Central supports the great stand-up, and we're happy to, tell you about it because they support our show a bit, the Comedy Central. Let me tell you, I'm going to be back in Boston area. The rescheduled dates are now. This Friday, the 29th, I will be at the Hooky Lao in Chicopee, Massachusetts. You can go to WTFpod.com for the ticket link. And on the 30th, I will be at the Wilbur Theater doing a live stand-up show and a live WTF featuring DJ Hazard, one of the legends, local legends of the Boston comedy scene, DJ Hazard. Without DJ Hazard, there's no Louis C.K. in the great comedy family tree. I've got Sue Costello. I've got Rick Jenkins. I've got Dan Crone. I've got George McDonald, who was the host of the first open mic I ever did in my life. Those are happening in Boston. Then April 4th through 6th, Crackers Comedy Club in Indianapolis, Indiana. Going to be pounding out the hour there. Excited. Haven't been back there in a long time. April 13th, I'll be at the Palace of Fine Arts in San Francisco. April 19th, I'll be at the Music Fest Cafe. It's very complicated. There's so many different names involved in these Bethlehem, Pennsylvania gigs. I'm not sure. If you live in Bethlehem, you'll figure it out. April 24th through April 27th, Moon Tower Comedy Festival, and I will be premiering my television show, Marin, there. I will be showing an episode and doing a Q&A. And doing a live WTF. And May 4th, I'll be at the Pabst Theater in Milwaukee. So, okay, on to other things. Those are the me plugs. I was just in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I took a trip. Jess wanted to go down to Carlsbad Caverns, and I grew up in New Mexico. She had been there when she was a kid and was sort of obsessed with it. So I'm like, all right, we're going to go. We're going to go to Carlsbad Caverns. Jess and I had a lovely time, although there's really only four restaurants you can sit down at in Carlsbad, New Mexico. It just seems brutal. I mean, I went to a Chili's, folks. I've not been to a Chili's in, I don't know, maybe 15, 20 years. And the only other time I went in there was out of necessity. Again, this was out of necessity. I walk into a Chili's. The place was packed, but somehow still seemed dead inside. That's all I can tell you. There was just something wrong. I'm sure I could explain it on a lot of levels, but, it was brutal. But we had a good time at the Caverns. We drove back up to Albuquerque where we went to Santa Fe for a few days. Stayed at 10,000 Waves up there. Did the spa thing. Had a massage. I got a massage. It was so deep. I think that tears from seventh grade came out of my face. It was a regular massage. There was no, you know, no sexy stuff. Then we went to Albuquerque and stayed at the Los Poblanos Inn. And I've told you about this place before, but this place is fucking amazing. I mean, how often can you say that you've gone to where you grew up, stayed literally a half a mile from where your house used to be, and not even known where you were because it was so beautiful? I mean, I can't even explain it, but I will say this, and this is not a paid plug. This is just something that I do, and I'm going to do again. You know, the Remby family, who owns these two properties down there that are now one property, you know, they've got a restaurant there. They got pigs on the premises. They got cows. I met a cow. I saw some pigs. You know, I apologized to the pigs, to what I'd done to their kind. Did not tip me towards the direction of not eating pigs, but I felt that there was an understanding between me and the pigs that I met along the pig, wavelength. Maybe I'm misreading it. Perhaps I will end miserably because of a pig, as many people will. It's a slow death by pig. That's what's going on in your chest, people. Pow! Look out. Just shit my pants. JustCoffee.coop, available at WTFpod.com. But what I'm saying is it's stunning. There are two homes on this property. They're not homes. There's a hacienda-style home, and then there's this huge sort of 1920s, 1930s ballroom-style home set back on all this land. There's little places where you can stay and walk. There's a beautiful restaurant. But I don't even know that I can explain it to you other than it's stunning. Los Poblanos in Albuquerque. If you need to go to Albuquerque on business or for any other reason, it's affordable and you won't know where you are. They have peacocks on the property. There's a barn. You can walk around. There's a little store. Peacocks. How often do you get to see that? I had an amazing time. And it's just rare that you go somewhere that doesn't feel like a contrived sort of environment. Saw my old man in Albuquerque. Had dinner with him. That was as easy as it was going to be. He did have an interesting pitch. We got to talking about manic depression and bipolar disorder, and he had read some sort of article about all the a list of celebrities that were bipolar. My father, being bipolar, finds a great comfort in finding other people who are bipolar, especially intelligent people or celebrities of sorts. So my dad looks at me. This is a man who has not listened to one of my podcasts. Cannot figure it out, supposedly. Not listen to one, my father. I'm not crying about it. But he looks at me honestly in the middle of dinner and says, they should do a show where you just got maybe five or six, you know, bipolar people, celebrities, talking, you know, maybe with a host, just, you know, talking with an audience. And I go about bipolarity. No, just about anything. Just because there's a, you know, they share this common thing and there's an intelligence to it that maybe they should just do a show on television that just features, you know, maybe five or six bipolar people. And I'm thinking like, well, there's a show that does that on the internet, kind of. They interview people about, you know, real stuff. It's called WTF Pod. I don't know if you know that one. But in terms of having five or six bipolar people on television at the same time, that's every show on television now. All right. So Adam Parfrey. What did Adam Parfrey do for me? There are certain books in your life that just blow your fucking mind. And Apocalypse Culture, which was edited by Adam Parfrey, did it. It pulled me into the world of sort of artistic morbid fascination, speculative science and weirdness, you know, types of art that I never conceived of or understood, conspiracy theories, you know, wrong-minded expressions of self. Wrong-minded, I say that, and you know who they are. I mean, there are people that do wrong-minded shit as a public entertainment or display specifically because they can. They have the right to do that because this is a beautiful country, and I certainly embrace that. But there's very few people that take advantage of it to the hilt. The wrong-minded expression of self in order to provoke. Adam is, you know, is a champion of that. And this, you know, this sent me spiraling into dark nerdism, you know, pulling together, learning about Manson, learning about conspiracy theories, watching morbid videos of Bud Dwyer blowing his brains out, trying to understand the great tapestry of occultism through conspiracy theories. There's dogma to conspiracies. There's a method of belief that is involved in believing conspiracies that they're true. Look, we'd all want them to be true. Look, I want the Freemasons, even the ancient Egyptians. I want to go back to this first guy with burning eyes who held a dagger over a goat and sent the whole thing spiraling into the system of government we have now that has been corrupted by witches and lizards. God damn it. I would love for that to be true. And there's been times in my life where I believe that is true. Because I wanted to believe it. How clear does it have to be? I don't know. A little clearer, I think, for it to be more than just a countering belief system. But look, whatever you hang your hat on, as long as it's not too dangerous, I guess it's okay. Can be entertaining to some. But my point is that, you know, I pulled out of the conspiracy racket because, you know, it still comes down to bullshit avoidance of practical problems. It's a sort of like, I've got the secret wisdom and this is what's really going on. And well, what do you do about it? I talk about it. But apocalypse culture sent me spiraling into that, into a lot of different areas. And I tell you, I was just thrilled because he was a mythological person to me, some sort of dark overlord of important information that nobody else had. Look, you've heard me do the stamps.com pitch before. But let me do it again, because if you have a small business, I really want you to listen up, because this can help you out. Mailing and shipping are important parts of running your small business, but it can get in the way of actually growing your business if you're constantly making trips to the post office. I know this. It happened to me. So use Stamps.com instead. With Stamps.com, everything you would do at a post office, you can do right from your desk. Buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package using your own computer and printer. Stamps.com will send you a digital scale, calculates the exact postage you need for any class of mail. You'll never need to go to the post office again, or even lease one of those expensive postage meters. No, you don't have to do that. If you're running a business, you don't want to create more work for yourself. We save a lot of time here by using Stamps.com. So right now, use my promo code WTF for this special offer. Start a no-risk trial plus a $110 bonus offer that includes digital scale and up to $55 of free postage. Don't wait. Go to Stamps.com. And before you do anything else, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in WTF. That's Stamps.com. Enter WTF. All right. Let's talk to Adam Parfrey from Feral House. So, Adam Parfrey, I got to be honest with you. I was nervous to talk to you.
Really?
Wow. Well, you have to understand that these books that you put out, Apocalypse Culture, what year was that, the first Apocalypse Culture?
87.
All right, 87. So 67 through 83. So I was about 25 years old when I found this book. I can't quite remember where I found the book, but it was at some bookstore that would have this book.
Mm-hmm.
And it fucking, you know, blew my mind. So then I started, you know, buying all the books that you were part of, mm-hmm. and with a Muck Press or with Feral House. And, you know, I had pictured you as some sort of, kind of some magician, some dark sorcerer, some guy that had, you know, that had an empire of weird shit that blows minds.
I must be a magician if you thought that.
I didn't know who you were. You were just, I'd see these pictures and I'm like, that's the guy. You were like the anti L. Ron Hubbard to me or something.
Just funny, because the Church of Scientology chased after me.
They did?
On one respect before that. You know that Jack Parsons, that Sex and Rockets book?
The Sex and Rockets, the first time I heard about that stuff was in City of Courts, the Mike Davis book.
Yeah.
There's a chapter in there on Parsons and Hubbard and the rocket scientists.
Yeah.
You did a book that was, which book did you do?
It's a biography about Parsons.
Uh-huh.
And a situation with Hubbard, L. Ron Hubbard.
Right.
A situation with Aleister Crowley. And being killed in a rocket or an explosion.
Parsons was.
Yeah.
And what was the premise of the book? What was the focus?
The focus is a biography specifically, because there's so much misinformation about this crazy guy, this very dark man, who Wernher von Braun credited Jack Parsons for promoting or creating the whole space program, because he found this sort of rocket fuel that lifted a rocket above the Earth's gravitational field.
That was Parsons.
That was Parsons.
And he's an American rocket scientist who was at USC, was he? Or
No, it was Caltech.
Caltech, right.
And then Jet Propulsion Laboratories he co-founded. But he was he was notably a crazy man, took loads of drugs, followed Aleister Crowley's magic and occultism.
Yeah.
He was like, at that point, rocketry was like sci-fi, science fiction.
Right.
It wasn't really considered practical.
There were no missiles. There was no space travel. There was just
these little rocket things. Right. But that not much was made of it.
Right.
It was like kids playing around. But that's what he was. He was a kid playing around.
Right.
And he created the whole space program. And before every rocket test, he would recite this poem called the Hymn to Pan. That was written by Aleister Crowley. Totally occult. Totally dark magic, whatever they call that.
So he was a scientist, but he also was a occult practitioner.
Yeah, but the thing is that it was the way he practiced the magic.
Yeah.
You know, then you have to ask yourself, what is magic?
Right.
It's just science, but people don't understand as being science, so it becomes magical to them, like cargo cults.
Well,
or something.
Let's explain that, because that's a big missing element of my education. Is that, look, I tried to tap into Crowley. I tried to understand. Yeah, you know, I read some book that I picked up at some kind of New Age bookstore called The Philosophy of Magic, and I think that sort of explained a little more to me about what magic did, and it really is a sequence of repetitions and mythologies that rejigger your mind into a type of focus that you would call the effect of magic.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're not going to manifest things. Do you believe?
Well, that's all questionable.
Okay, now, so let's deal with the science then. You said there's a science of magic.
Well, what I was just trying to put across was that science is considered by many to be magic before it becomes science.
Okay, right.
Because then it's practical. You can repeat the idea of it and then do it again.
Right.
You know?
Right.
But then, the the cargo cult in New Guinea or wherever sees the airplanes flying over and dropping these containers of food or what have you during the World War II.
Yeah.
So they make these icons. They build these ideas of what these airplanes are to summon these gods back to New Guinea to give them food again.
Right.
But there are more practical ways of doing that. But it's interesting. I think it's fascinating because I'm writing a script about it, actually, a movie script.
The Parsons story?
About Parsons, because
What was the Hubbard connection, just so people know?
Hubbard lived with Parsons for a while. And he did some magical rituals.
With the three of them, right? The wife, too, right? Wasn't Parsons' wife part? Wasn't there a...
There's this woman named Cameron.
Yeah.
They did these things. But specifically with Hubbard, he did it together. And then there are some rituals. He's actually jerking off in front of L. Ron Hubbard and doing these mystical rituals. I don't have a personal belief that if I jerk off and say these words that something mystical is going to happen. But Parsons did. And look, he's part of the American space program.
No warheads without Parsons.
No warheads.
So on some level, it all gets sort of tied together in these secret histories and these interpretations of things, because, I mean, one of the most provocative pieces in the original apocalypse culture to me was that the downward piece, the King Kill 33.
Downward,
Downward. And this was all sort of a almost schizophrenic interpretation of Masonic symbolism in how it relates to global domination.
Yeah.
Right. So there's a poetry to the whole thing. But you sort of become fascinated with these latitudes, that the earth was broken down into these latitudes, that the one that always sticks with me in terms of, growing up in New Mexico in the land of enchantment was that you have the King Kill, ritual or ceremony, which was in his eyes, the killing of Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
But then also there's the nuclear tests, that took place in southern New Mexico that also play into one of the other sort of, I'm assuming he's drawing exactly from Masonic literature, that there were certain things that needed to happen for the Masonic global rule to occur.
Well, specifically the space program, they brought a Masonic flag to the moon.
Mm-hmm.
and they Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong, before they landed with the landing craft, they enact a ritual at a certain geography on the moon.
Uh-huh.
And so isn't that strange? This is science, is it not?
Right.
Like, and it seems a little mystifying to me. How do these people got involved with this situation? But if you go back, that's why I did that Ritual America book I sent you.
Because, yeah, it looks great.
But when you go through it, it's all about how the Masonic ideas and fraternal brotherhoods and secret societies, and why were they secret initially anyway, and how they were integral into the formation of the country, and what they did and what were they there for. You know, it's not Sarah Palin's concept of Christianized. These are very Egyptian, pagan, other cultural concepts.
And how do they explain it away? That, yeah, hey, it's like the Elks Lodge. Hey, you know, we're just guys who meet and do this thing. In terms of what I needed to do to free myself from, a complete conspiratorial nervous breakdown because of you. You know, at some point I had to say, well, secret societies is how power is consolidated and maintained. No matter what, whether there's ritual or not.
Mm-hmm.
There's a brotherhood of trust that then enacts whatever nasty business they have to enact in order to gain control of something.
Well, it makes perfect sense, really. Initially, what it was is that the Catholics and the monarchy controlled finances. They controlled life in that time and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you run against that and you run your own little financial situation, like some pirates in Scotland, mm-hmm. a guy named John Sinclair, and that was the opposing monetary system and a belief system as well, and very threatening to the Catholic structure. And so up to today, if you read the popes, say he's got things online, you can read them, how he opposes Freemasonry entirely and how it's...
Currently.
Oh, yeah.
And this has been going on for 1,000 years or more.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. So even today. So the thing is that in respect to John F. Kennedy, he was an opposing member. He didn't talk about it that much, except he did have a speech about secret societies or something being not good. You can find that on YouTube. But in any case, John F. Kennedy was Catholic.
Right.
You know, what was so damn threatening about that? You
right.
know, but it was because Freemasonry is a Protestant concept, and it's run by people who are Protestants, basically.
Uh-huh.
And so it was an opposing religious point of view. It's fascinating how the whole country is structured that way. If you go to any small town in this country, you'll see there's the original Masonic Lodge, the original Oddfellows Lodge, all that stuff. And why are they these weird outfits? What do they do in these meetings? It's like, you know, are they all like barbers, like the honeymooners or something?
Right.
Or what?
And what did you come up with?
It was the structure of a good old boy networks, basically.
Right.
And they had higher up levels and lower levels.
Right.
You know?
When does it become insidious, and why is Freemasonry, you know, certainly from the Christian point of view and in some eschatology, is a precursor or an active instigator of a one world government?
The Illuminati idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
isn't that tied in with Freemasonry?
Of course it's tied in, but for the not specific, those people say this is a crock and it's not really what happens and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Let's see, it's not like those little Christian booklets or those chick booklets or
tracks.
Know,
yeah.
Tracks, of course, like they got that track place down the street. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
So, no, it's fascinating because there is something. There is the Illuminati structure at the basis of it. A guy named Adam Weishaupt invented it. And so what Adam Weishaupt did, it was an anti-Catholic, anti-monarchical, revolutionary aspect.
Where you took aristocratic people, thinking people of all kinds, and you created clubhouses where they could meet and engage in ritual, create a brotherhood, and slowly undermine the Catholic institutions.
Absolutely. And that was the institution. So it was extremely threatening.
But did it start in Europe then?
Yeah, there's the Grand Orient Lodge, which is France and surrounding countries. Also, how do you explain this? Because the UK, Britain had their own Freemasonry thing.
Yeah. But,
what's the difference, you know? But there was a, there are opposing views of their things. There was, Britain became anti-Catholic in a sense, with Luther and Henry VIII and trying to marry and all that. So these things were worked out hundreds of years before that, really. Mm-hmm. But still, there was, the Freemasons in America were aligned with the French ones, the Grand Orient.
Right.
And against the British ones.
So these were, in a sense, I mean, in terms of what hold they have on the world now, it's a residual effect. That you're saying, like, because I understand that Ben Franklin was, that some of these early founding fathers were Freemasons. They were involved in a lodge. That Ben Franklin was quite the party animal, and that he was one of the Hellfire Lodge Masons. Where was that, in France?
Yeah. And England too.
Yeah.
So
some people, maybe it is an actual historical fact, believe that the revolution that led to the colonization of America was birthed in a Freemason hall.
Sure.
And that there are some people that believe that Adam Weishaupt, was actually, there are pictures of George Washington in a Freemason apron.
Oh, no.
And some people believe that perhaps, you know, the Weishaupt Washington thing is a little hazy. I don't remember what that particular theory is. Today,
you think, who are these guys? It was like the lodges are falling apart. There are far fewer Masons today than ever before. Hmm. The lodges are breaking down.
So is Catholic Church.
Well, yeah. Yeah. So, well, there you have it. But
so they won.
Another thing is that where are they important? Are they still important in any way or any structure today in America? And I think they are in certain respects with cops, with the military. Because if you look through, I put that in the book,
yeah,
about all this stuff about the Middle East and Israel and this warfare in Iraq, they were obsessed with Baghdad. And there's all this stuff about that. Why? If they feel that was the basis of the origin of this Masonic concept, is indeed comes from there.
The where they meet is the Temple Mount, in the rebuilding of the Second Temple. In order for Jesus to come back, the Second Temple needs to be rebuilt. The Dome of the Rock sits on that space, and they cannot get up there.
Right.
So the Temple Mount is actually the most significant place in the Jewish religion, and they can only get as close as the wall to the Temple Mount. So in order for the temple to be rebuilt, the Muslims have to be moved off the site. So you're saying that somehow that bit of Christian lore, Freemason lore, and is somehow informing some of the military activity that is going on there.
I believe so.
But who knows this? I mean, are you telling me that Donald Rumsfeld was hip to this shit? That
of course
Dick Cheney
was. Yeah, they're in these in-groups, are they not?
But they're modern people. You're telling me that Rumsfeld and Cheney and well, certainly not Bush Jr., but maybe Bush Sr.
What is Skull and Bones?
I get it. The Yale Secret Society.
Yeah.
But that was a guarantee of aristocratic power. So it's all the same shit to you.
Yeah, but why did they have Geronimo's skull in there?
Because they were kids and it seemed like a... See, in order to, like, and I go along with you, and you're my teacher in this, that you know, I understand that there is a mystical relevance and also a poetic and very ritual relevance of taking one of the most powerful leaders of the indigenous people to the United States and having them in this sort of secret society aristocratic training camp lodge for its magical value.
Yeah.
And I think what we're getting to is that the magical value of that is relative to your belief in the power that you are inheriting.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
So basically, to have possession of that magical thing, which is the head of Geronimo, is in itself, you know, sort of, you know, buttressing your natural legacy as an aristocratic leader in this country.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, also, yeah, but that's That's true, but that's meaningful, is it not, that they believe these things?
No, I agree with you. I agree that, you know, that the Catholic Church is sort of a demonic place of weird witchcraft. I don't think you have to deconstruct it that much, and I certainly think that the events of the last few years in relation to uncovering what I imagine is a centuries and centuries long tradition of child abuse and ritual child abuse, I would imagine, in that they were passing these kids around.
Sure.
Once you transgress, or once you cross a line, you know, in action, you enter a magical space. You know, and how you navigate that is really up to you. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the assumption is most of what we're talking about is being navigated for dark purposes.
Well,
for global domination and power.
Yeah. In respect to apocalypse culture or the things I publish about that, I'm not a believer in anything. I just look at these aspects. I find it fascinating because these belief systems conflict with the New York Times or the paper of record, or and it, that, that's just like it's considered craziness, but it's a part of American history and things that happened. Like I have a picture of Andrew Mellon, who was the second richest man in America in the 30s at the Mellon Banks and all that stuff.
Right.
And so what's he doing? Doing a cornerstone ritual of this new building in Washington, D.C. with his name on it. He's holding a Masonic trowel. He's doing an initiation cornerstone ritual with a new IRS building. What the hell does a government building have to do with a Masonic ritual? And why? And why is his name on it? What's going on there? It was important, obviously, if they're enacting these rituals. I have photographs of FDR doing that Masonic trowel ritual with a Jefferson Memorial in D.C. and other things. So it's just unending amounts, and it was really important, a big part of our culture, big part of our political structure.
It's a ruling class.
Yes. Yes,
and they wanted to make sure that the signals and signs were out there for those who understood them, and that was not to be fucked with.
Yeah,
but okay, so like getting away from that, you know, the original books that, you know, your fascination.
Well, oh, by the way,
yeah,
you mentioned James Shelby Downard, right?
Yeah.
As being an influence of some sort on you.
The piece of writing that's in the first Apocalypse Culture, which I don't know why you didn't put in the second one. Was there a reason for that?
Yeah, because I wanted more material. I didn't want to repeat it. There were, you know, 30,000 copies of that book around.
Yeah.
And I wanted more Downard without going through the same thing again.
Was there more in here?
I can't remember. There was a thing about the atom bomb airing.
Oh, right, but that's the other one I was thinking of. Right.
So that's in that edition.
Oh.
And the Kingkill 33. But anyway, Kingkill 33 is also in part in the Ritual America book. But however, I want to say that I'm very excited because Downard has become a character in a movie I had co-written that's going to be made this year.
Oh, really?
About the Kennedy assassination. It's a kind of a thriller, conspiracy thriller of sorts, and it's being produced this coming year for the 50th anniversary time.
Wow.
Can you believe that? It's shocking and striking, but I'm very excited about this.
And is it from that angle, or is he just representing that angle?
He is a character in the movie, you know, what his perspective on things.
What do you think he was? You knew him.
I went down to Memphis to meet him, yeah.
He's dead now?
Oh, yeah.
And where'd you find him?
He was introduced to me by a couple weird old Fortiana type guys. And, it was shocking to me. Weird, crazy, interesting. Cause I've never seen the perspective of that. I guess,
I don't think it's, to do it so, poetically.
Yeah.
Yeah. And to take, you know, to read almost every word within the prime, you know, the key players within the assassination. I mean, to deconstruct Jack Ruby's name along the lines of the significance of the ruby and of the color.
Yeah.
Yeah. In relation to Masonic symbolism.
Yeah.
Was, what do you think of his sanity?
Well, I'm so glad he's a little bit insane.
Mm-hmm.
Because if he didn't have if he his brain was structured like everybody's, like mine or my neighbors or whatnot, you would not go there.
Yeah.
And do you take it seriously in a way that this is the answer to it? No, but it opens up your mind to a grand perspective of reading things or seeing things or living. And it was like, it was quite eye-opening to me, and it changed my life, really.
That was one of the things?
Absolutely.
And that was the before you published the first Apocalypse Culture.
Yeah.
So that sort of served for you as sort of a catalyst to engage a fascination in alternate understandings of reality.
It was a great influence in that respect, yeah.
I think I've got the first three exits.
Oh, yeah, that was before that.
I've got the first three editions of Exits that I found in a garbage can in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Wow.
In 19...
That was a good find for a garbage can.
Well, they were all together. It was almost as if someone said, I can't handle it. It was like, they were just, they were pristine. I have them up there. And I had no idea what they were. I'd never seen them before. Yeah. So it was 1988, probably. So when did they come out?
83, 84.
So like, I don't know how they ended up there or why.
Yeah.
But I started going through this stuff and I'm like, what the fuck is this? I mean, just a full huge page of the universe with Manson's eyes in the middle of it. or the Beatles standing with Hitler overlooking, what were they overlooking? Like the planet Earth or something?
Well, there were World War II plans, you know.
Right. And it was the Beatles with Hitler looking. Yeah. And like it just was like, what is this? What does this mean? Why is this happening in my head?
Yeah. Well,
is that what you wanted to happen?
Absolutely wanted that to happen. You kidding me? It's sort of like that anybody would look at it and it would strike their consciousness in any way. That's of course. But that point, I did that with a friend. His name was George Petros.
Yeah, who was that guy? I got obsessed with his name too. I started trying to do research on him. I'm like, what am I supposed to glean? Does anyone else know about this shit?
Well, he's an odd bird for sure, but
still around.
Oh yeah, yeah. He lives in New York. He had just some books he published or himself on kind of a third or fourth sex and weird ideas. But we parted ways after the first three issues of Exit.
So that was it. The ones I have.
Well, he did a couple other issues beyond that himself that I wasn't involved with.
Well, okay. So let's go back with you a little bit and then get up to speed. You grew up here.
Mostly. My father was an actor, and he moved from New York to L.A. in 62.
Was he, what roles was he? He was a character actor, right?
Yeah. He was in, he's probably best known for being in Planet of the Apes and Dirty Harry and Papillon and a lot of, hundreds of TV shows.
What was his name?
Woodrow Parfrey.
So you grew up sort of in, a little bit in the studio system in a way.
Well, he took me to sound stages and stuff. And
uh-huh.
I go over the scripts with them. And
yeah.
And it was, I thought everybody's family was involved with it. It seemed that way out here. We lived in Brentwood, and it's like, yeah, the neighbor is a character actor named Bert Fried, and his son's like going to school.
It was just like, this is an
everyday thing.
It's an industry town.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just the industry was, the dreams and movies.
No, that's what everybody did. They went to work in studios and made TV shows.
Right, it's still like that. It is.
But
you didn't have any weird, because like, there's the other trajectory that I think, preceded you, which was the Kenneth Anger, kind of that Crowley connection.
Yeah.
And also there's, you put out a book that I see here about, where Hollywood's Hellfire Club.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, that the dark percolations of Hollywood was always pretty there.
Absolutely. But Anger really brought that out in the Hollywood Babylon. Yeah.
But so you start out here, and then what happens for you? Where did you go from here? I mean, did you?
Well, I grew up, I went to UCLA, I dropped out of UCLA, went up to UC Santa Cruz. I was in punk rock at that time. It was in the 70s. And then I thought in 1978 punk rock was over and not really interesting anymore. So I went up to...
You were in a band?
I did actually, what I did was, I did a newspaper called Idea.
Uh-huh.
And it was sort of like, I wanted to do, I was sick and tired of music per se.
Yeah.
Everything's about punk rock. Everybody's in a band.
Yeah.
That's not interesting.
Right.
So I wanted to have a, like an unorthodox punky attitude towards whatever.
Yeah.
So I picked up on that and did a newsprint paper that way.
In Santa Cruz.
Santa Cruz and San Francisco later.
Two very bizarrely mystical, fucked up places.
I guess so. But the paper wasn't necessarily that mystical itself. Yeah. But in any case, it was. And so I moved to New York after that. I tried to start a bookstore because I was searching through, I think, drug experiences and being on speed or not staying up all night and step up until next day. And I found that Goodwill was throwing out hundreds and thousands of books, and they're taking it through dumpsters, the
uh-huh.
to the city dump and yeah. all that. And I saw that they were throwing out the good books and they only kept the bad books.
Ah.
And they said, I said, well, can we get some of those books you're throwing out?
Yeah.
They said, yeah, but you're going to have to truck them out. So I had to buy a book truck. And so I learned about publishing that way. I learned by going through all the Goodwill.
By a vision on
trash.
Speed. Yeah, you're
on speed.
Jacked up on Benny's.
That's for sure. Yeah.
I got a project.
And I tell you, those were dark apocalyptic moments of my life, you know.
Yeah, were they?
Oh, just yeah.
Looking at piles of books and dumpsters thinking like, this is my future? Dark moment.
It was dark. Besides that, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, I learned the industry. So I moved out to New York. I sold these things, pennies on the dollar, and then I just got the hell out. I went to New York because my family, my father, mother, you know, they grew up with plays, theater and live TV and that whole thing. And so this was kind of like the promised land.
New York.
Yeah, but it was, you know, what it was.
Oh, being on speed in San Francisco in the early 80s.
With the guys from Flipper and other band, Toiling Midgets. And
there are some pockets in San Francisco that are still beyond my comprehension that I can't, you know, you get off of the BART on 16th and Mission and you're like, what the fuck is happening here? It's like there's just that corner where you just feel some tangible chaos that, you know, anything could just fucking hit you in the head and you don't know what the hell is going to happen.
And it probably will hit you in the head with cholos down there. So.
But like I was there in the, you know, in the late 80s and I definitely could never, like, I think that either you're sensitive to, you know, I don't want to say vibrations, but definitely to, you know, there's something in the air up there. Mm-hmm. Like, I never knew, like, you go to New York, you're like, I know who's in charge here. You go uptown, there they are. Those are the kings, and there's a grid, and we understand how this is laid out. But in San Francisco, I always got this feeling, like, what the fuck is happening here?
Yeah.
What is that about San Francisco? Was it always sort of a mecca for individualists and crackpots and art?
Yeah. Yeah. The reason I moved, because of that, it was this weird vibe going on, but it was like no one was ever getting anything done.
Right.
Also,
mm-hmm.
it was all, you know, drugs and weirdness and, and just, it was, after a while I had enough of that. So I went to a place where supposedly things were being done.
There's
New
a
York.
Grid. Yeah, yeah. You went to where the grid was, not just hills and curvy streets.
Yeah. Yeah. And all my friends that maybe they'll show up, maybe they won't, maybe it'll, you know, it's like that.
Right.
Sense of,
and speed doesn't help the time continuity either.
I guess not.
So you meet Petros.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's just, you're fascinated by the way his brain works. So this was, was he the first guy that was sort of like, that made it clear to you that there's something else going on that needs to be?
Well, what was going on with Petros is that he was a cartoonist.
Yeah.
And he wanted to do put a monograph of his work. And he was a good illustrator, a good cartoonist. But I said, this would be far more interesting if we did a collection of various things and had some ideas going. So here we are, you know, we're doing drugs and all that stuff, and there were energizing thoughts. He was, he thought about alternative views of history, you know, Philip Dick style things, mm-hmm. and that he was responsible for these great reconstructions of the New York Times daily front pages and stuff like that. If other things happen.
Oh, that's, like, that's in the front page of the Exit, one of them.
Yeah.
Or maybe all of them.
Well, they have had that front page thing in each edition. But right. The, so he was very interested in sci-fi and Phil Dick and this kind of thing. And,
yeah.
And then I was interested in other, like, weird historical aspects like that, the Charlie Manson, Beatles, Hitler yeah. stuff.
Right.
That was my photo collages stuff. Mm-hmm. So that's, so we had our own thing.
And I, what was the fascination with Manson? Because that continued for a while.
Well, it had to do a lot to do with Boyd Rice, I think. With Boyd Rice.
He just sent me his book.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Who is Boyd Rice? Because he, like, you really created, you know, for some of us. I mean, mm-hmm. obviously, a lot of people who are listening to this aren't going to know what we're talking about or yeah. why. But certainly in San Francisco, when I was there in the early 90s, mm-hmm. and I don't remember, where was the Farrell House store? You had a store for a while, right?
No, we never had a store. There was a Muck store in L.A.
A Muck, right. That's right.
Yeah.
But you were only tangentially
yeah,
involved
there was
with them.
Yeah. Yeah.
But... All right, that's right. So, you know, there was a Manson thing going on. There was this, it revolved around zines, around weird, you know, cassette recordings of things, videotape of like Bud Dwyer shooting himself in the head. There was also the nose, which my buddy Jack Boulware was the editor of.
Yeah.
That there was this weird craving that I think came a little after the zines or around the same time for alternate information. Of any kind.
Yeah.
And Manson seemed to play a big part in that for you. And who what was his name? Nick Brugis?
Nick Brugis, yeah.
Nick Brugis.
Well, the thing is that what did Manson represent? What was that all about, you know?
The crucifixion of the 60s.
Well, yeah. Yeah, but it was... If you listen to that guy, a crazy guy,
mm-hmm.
didn't make much sense, however. But there was something about him... In the way he would talk, and it's not like we were cultists run after Manson, but it had a fascination because the cult idea, people following person who's so far out with his ideas,
yeah.
and he brings them there, that was refreshing, particularly at a time when it's all about Suzanne Summers cookbooks.
Right.
You know, there was no internet. You know, mm-hmm. and it was sort of like, and at that point, we weren't overdone with all that serial killer crap.
Right.
And it was a different perspective at that moment. Now, if you think back, Manson's so, yeah, who cares?
Yeah.
But at that point, it was a
way to fight against the status quo. Is to elevate.
It's not even a fight. It was just people. Felt that there was something horribly vastly wrong with it.
Yeah.
And get the hell away from it.
Right.
And then we just have fun with that reactivity, you know?
Right. You just want to stick it to the regular people.
Yeah, but then, you know, with these farthest collages about, like, I used the Book of Revelation where he did a notation of it. That was Boyd Rice owned that particular book where Manson notated
the Book of Revelation.
The Book of Revelation.
Where did he get that from? Charlie himself?
Forget where. I don't think it was from him himself, but it was from some other thing. Mm-hmm. So in any case, so I thought, well, let's do a collage, and I'm not sure if I took it serious, but it was a great way to inspire a creative and unorthodox look at society and things, and like, yeah, you don't do that to the Beatles. Mm-hmm. You don't. Why? You know?
Yeah.
And but you know, because the Beatles are gods
with
you know?
Hitler.
And Hitler, of course, but there was a connection, as far as I could see, you know.
Between the Beatles and Manson and Hitler.
Beatles, Manson, Hitler, yeah.
Well, oddly, a few of the biggest, you know, ideas that I ever, that were sort of, you know, mind-changing ideas was that what I got out of that, what was provoked in me was the nature of commercialism and the nature of... Mm-hmm. You know, being elevated to mythic status,
yeah.
and what that requires,
mm-hmm.
and also how it's maintained,
right?
So there was a totalitarian, almost fascistic mm-hmm. Suggestion within that piece of art
mm-hmm.
that made me rethink, you know, why are the Beatles so fucking revered?
Yeah.
I mean, sure, they were great musicians, and arguably there are other musicians that are as good, but how did they seize that moment and hold it for so long? It wasn't just on them.
Well, that's what we used, the totalitarian aesthetics.
Right.
You know, at that point, what was really big was, you know, was, who's that guy who did that Mouse book and this Raw magazine?
Spiegelman.
Spiegelman did these, like, these poor, bedraggled Jewish
mice.
Yeah, or mice, or a cartoon artist.
Right.
I'm tired of that.
Yeah.
That aesthetic, you
right.
know? Let's go elsewhere.
And that's also the Arkram aesthetic. You're tired of the standard.
Well, Arkram I love, but all that. But the thing is that was everything.
Yeah, underground comics.
That was everything. There was no alternative to that, actually.
Right.
And so I put that out, and Spiegelman got so upset with Exit Magazine, because there shouldn't only be one large format serial art magazine.
Which was Raw.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what he did, he got it banned from these stores like Forbidden Planet and Sahozat in New York City.
Spiegelman did?
Yeah.
Really?
He called them up, said, you can't carry that.
What was his beef? Did he think you were being anti-Semitic?
Probably. But...
Were you?
Whatever provoked satisfied me. Really.
But when pushed to the wall, you'd be like, hey, I'm just, you know, what are you
well,
not
look,
worked
look,
up about?
My mother's Jewish. Come
yeah.
on.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, what the fuck?
All right. So it's payback.
So, yeah, call me whatever you want. But if it, you know, if it stimulates thought and provokes like it did with you, that's perfect. That's exactly the intent.
Yeah, and I'm a Jew, you know, and you know, the things that really stand out to me about the Exits were the Manson eyes in the middle of the universe, and and the Beatles, you know, looking at the plans, mm-hmm. that there was some sort of secret meeting with Adolf Hitler and the Beatles, and they were overlooking the agenda or whatever it may be.
Yeah,
that what that spurred me was to look at commercialization and myth making in a different way.
Yeah, Grail Marcus actually wrote a good review about that piece somewhere.
Oh, did he?
Yeah.
He's a thinky guy.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah.
So Manson and, all right, now the Rants, this was also, you know, a tremendous book for me that you put out. Bob Black and Adam Parfy. This was out of Feral House, right? Or a Muck.
Luponics. Yeah.
And what this book is just these weird, you know, a collection of the ones I like best are the ones that are just sort of the scrawl of barely sane people. Some of them, you know, famous, some of them not so famous. I think the Futurist Manifesto meant, you know, had an effect on me. And there was an Ezra Pound piece in here.
Yeah.
And the Wilhelm Reich thing, who was also not unlike, you know, you, I mean, in spiritually, or not spiritually, but intellectually in the same place.
Yeah.
You know, that this, you know, kind of a complete fucking, you know, manic personality insisting that orgone energy exists.
I've got this book of his called Contact with Space. We went out to the Arizona desert, okay,
mm-hmm.
with these cloud busting devices.
Right, the cloud buster. That was the last straw, I think.
Point them up to the sky and supposedly shoot down with these cloud busters
mm-hmm.
the extraterrestrial aircraft, which he called EAs.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so that Contact with Space, an entire book about it. And what's interesting is the guy who did the drawings of that Shrek book, what was that cartoonist?
Yeah.
He was there with them and was part of that. And other people. It was not just him alone.
Well, there were Reichian schools.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that still to this day, I mean, I have it up there, the mass psychology of fascism and personality types are still fairly, you know, reputable texts in psychology.
Yeah.
He just went off the reservation.
Yeah.
And they, at some point, they had to kick him out once he started building metal boxes and jerking off in them and making guns to communicate with extraterrestrials. You know, there was a problem with the old guard. I would imagine the Masonic equivalent of the psychiatry old boys
and
network.
Also creating life forms. They called bions. Okay.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So he was like godlike. He would create through, you know, through chemical substances,
uh-huh.
a living being
did
that he would, you know, photograph through his microscope and so on.
So, but in your mind, I'm assuming there's no reason to pathologize any of these, you know, heroes of mental exploration, and that, you know, it's easy to dismiss behavior, I think, and I think there's a dogma to it when you start saying, well, oh yeah, he was just had a psychotic break.
Yeah.
You know, why trivialize the catharsis of that mental state?
I'm glad you put it that way. That's my whole reason for being right now. There's the skeptics out there, and I can understand that. I understand their belief system and what they say. If you can't, like, replicate something,
right.
It's like, but I don't think everything is worthless. Or,
right.
And I, why say that if you are unable to replicate it in a certain way, that it means it cannot be done? I don't believe that.
Or even if it can't be done, I think it's a problem with context. I think it's a problem like, well, if this guy is saying, you know, why not just take the poetry of it and let it do what it's going to do to you?
Mm-hmm.
You know, instead of getting hung up on science or pseudoscience of whether something can or can't be done, look at the amazing language of a guy at the end of his fucking rope. Yeah, speculating and assuming or insisting things that are fucking ridiculous or crazy, because the momentum of a lot of these a lot of what's in here, these incendiary tracks, the passion and desperation and anger and clarity that they're experiencing is something that you can feel.
Yeah,
and why isn't that enough?
Reich would call these people like that little men.
Right,
right. And he had a whole book on that, Listen, Little Man, about people who could not be accepting of things outside their small, little, limited perspectives. And it was very influential to me, that book.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, you only live so long.
Yeah.
And it's like you enjoy life.
Yeah.
And understand the greatness of things, you
right.
know?
Mm-hmm.
Why pay so much attention on these minuscule, like, Talmudic type of aspects of it.
Right,
know?
Right.
Why?
Let it bend a little.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
break it open. What's that? It's like that Burroughs riff where he said that, grammar was a dogmatic structure?
Oh, yeah.
You know, if you start to identify dogma as just sort of ingrained belief systems,
mm-hmm.
It's all restrictive, and mm-hmm. there's very few things that aren't mm-hmm. after a certain amount of time,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, all right, so moving past that, now, your relationship with Anton LaVey,
mm-hmm.
what is his title? Is he the inventor or the chief or the head of the Church of Satan?
He created it.
Right.
Created the Church of Satan.
And you had a relationship with his daughter?
Zena?
Yeah.
Briefly. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, he was your bread and butter for a while, right?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean,
you published the Satanic Bible.
No, I didn't do that one. That's out and with a major New York company. And
yeah.
Satanic Bible, Satanic Rituals, that's a New York house. First book I put out was a Satanic Witch, which was earlier called another edition, The Complete Witch. And now it's Satanic Witch, and then The Devil's Notebook.
Right, Devil's Notebook. All these very popular with women I dated in the late 80s.
Were they? Sometimes wives didn't like them too much. But the... that's another thing. It's
what?
Like, that's what I kept hearing. It's like, oh, I got apocalypse culture, but my wife told me to throw that out, and I can't keep it here. Or I got in a big fight with my girlfriend. And
over what?
Over...
some of the dirty, misogynistic, horrible things in here?
I don't know.
Now, what about Peter Sotos?
What about Peter Sotos? He's a good friend of mine, actually, and I've toured with him recently on the Ritual American. He brought out a book called Pure Filth that he did with the porn star now dead, Jamie Gillis.
Yeah. Oh, Jamie. Yeah. He was a nice guy. He was a San Francisco guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Went to Columbia. We ran into him once in over there in North Beach.
Unusual nice guy.
Yeah. I didn't really know him, but like he was in one of the first porns I saw in opening of Misty Beethoven. So I was familiar with his work, But he was sort of like a fairly well-adjusted, bright guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. Well, that could be argued how well-adjusted okay. he is. But but he did these films
yeah.
that Boogie Nights movie did a takeoff on, where they pick people up at porn stars,
or right.
porn stores, and then
right.
have them
fuck in the car
or other places. And that, so he had this whole series of kind of like reality porn, you know?
Well, that became a thing. I mean, yeah. What's his name? Dirty Debutantes, Powers, Ed Powers. And,
yeah.
And then the Butt Man, Seymour Butts.
Yeah, they're all takeoffs
right.
of Jamie's stuff. So the Burt Reynolds character in that Boogie Nights, that was based on.
On Gillis?
On Gillis, yes.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Huh.
Oh, yeah. So, what Sotos did, he transcribed all these things, and he liked it because it sounded like that, how he described it to me, it sounded like Andy Warhol's book, A, where it's just all these people in the factory
yeah.
mouthing off nonsense for
yeah.
hours. And but here it was, and it brought another perspective to these things entirely. And I found it interesting, and I published it. So, Pure Filth.
Yeah, and that was the take was that, you know, what it was set against was the sort of hackneyed and mockable dialogue of produced porn,
mm-hmm.
and this was sort of like had an improvisational nature toward yeah. a reality to it because yeah. it was happening in real time.
You get it, absolutely. Yeah, that's uh-huh. what it is, and it's like, and it's a very interesting thing because of who are these people? Were they horrors? What's the perspective of it?
Right.
What that sadistic, masochistic interaction with them?
Right.
It was really curious, you know.
And Soto. So, but there was some problem with the original Pure, right? Was
oh,
that
yeah.
the name of the book? Which was like, was that a? What is a? It was a first person narrative of a.
It was a magazine, kind of like, you know, the zine world, but
yeah.
it wasn't really a zine per se because zines didn't really. Taken off by that time, but it was earlier than that. So it's so we did these, you know, it's kind of juvenile stuff, you know. But he'd like say really awful, nasty things, but in a very satiric way.
But wasn't a lot of it focused on pedophilia?
Pedophilia,
yeah,
all the worst stuff,
just the bad shit.
All the bad shit.
Yeah,
yeah, but so. He was put in jail for that for a bit, for this magazine,
yeah.
for thought crimes, basically.
Uh-huh.
And so that was a perspective of apocalypse culture. What is a thought crime,
uh-huh.
per se? Not of actual behavior, but of a thought crime.
Right.
And that happened, you know, time and again, like the images in the apocalypse culture, too.
Yeah.
I can't print that book anywhere because of these...
What was that? Was that the one with the Hitler? Oh, that was the other thing in the Exit, the Hitler pictures with kids.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
So what can't you print?
The Pixies used that, one of those Hitler with kids images for their...
What can't you put in here? Which ones? Which pictures?
Do you see the color?
Oh, yeah.
Section?
Yeah. yeah.
There was a German artist named Blala Hallman.
Yeah.
And then this artist in Minnesota that lives in Berlin now. What's his name? But he, you know, he did a lot of paintings of children.
Yeah.
In sexual poses.
Right.
And so this sort of thing, you know, these are thought crimes, really. And you can't, you know, you can print them in various countries. But
these are blacked out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
By I didn't do that intentionally. That was ordered by the printer.
Oh, really?
But later the printer said, we just won't do this. And no printer would do it.
Right.
So it's now out of print, and it's not going to be reprinted. It's just some people better get it used because it's not going to be any such thing again.
And do you think this is a... is it a constitutional issue? Is it a theocratic issue?
Well, the issue thought was strange... was that every week at that time when I put that out, there was some weird pornographic style JonBenet Ramsey obsession. There was no tabloid paper without JonBenet Ramsey on the cover. the whole thing about children being tortured and raped,
mm-hmm.
like an obsession, like mm-hmm. you couldn't get enough of that.
Well, that's what made that story sordid, was that, you know, she was raped and murdered and no one knew why. And then it was just, there was a never-ending catalog of pictures of her dressed up like a grown-up.
And then there was this TV movie.
Yeah.
Where they had her in, like, panties, and it was crazy. I was just like, what is American culture? What's American consciousness? What's going on there?
Yeah.
And so I tried to figure this out with this apocalyptic concept, and then also with what is the art of it? What are the laws? What's going on? Why are these laws not affecting National Enquirer, but they affect an actual artist,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that those are things, ideas we're picking up on in that book. But the but we couldn't print it, although National Enquirer could print their stuff.
What's your explanation for that? I mean, what is your thinking around that? That, you know, when it comes to...
As long as you make money, that's okay.
Right.
And there's an interesting influence on tabloids with government reasons.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it became sort of clear to me answer to that question for me was that, you know, in the 80s, during the Reagan administration, that, you know, you had the Meese Commission on Pornography, and this was, you know, this was a battlefront,
mm-hmm.
you know, though, you know, a fictional one.
Mm-hmm.
But now, where, you know, you can get, you know, porn is fucking everywhere.
Yeah.
You don't hear word one about it
from
the Christian right or anywhere. And all you hear, you know, vaguely, what's going to end up happening really is what you'll start to hear about is an epidemic of porn addiction and a bunch of emasculated, impotent fucking idiots who have rewired their brains to, mm-hmm. you know, only be able to jerk off to pornography.
Mm-hmm.
So, but that public fight against porn mm-hmm. is completely irrelevant now. It just went away because the money that porn generates now because of the internet is beyond anything that we can imagine. And you know how that money works. Everyone's getting a piece of that somehow, right?
Yeah, piece of the pie, but the American pie. You know?
So,
but
what are your thoughts about in all that you've done and what you've continued to do? What's been won and what's been lost? I mean, you know, you talk about the internet and the thing that came to my mind is the, you know, Goad's Answer Me, the first three issues mm-hmm. of Answer Me were vile masterpieces.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then there was a Murder Can Be Fun, that zine. Mm-hmm. I don't remember who did that. Do you?
Johnny Marr?
Yeah. I mean, that time is behind us. And mm-hmm. now, you know, with very little effort, that alternative information or the provocative
mm-hmm.
sort of, you know, mind fucking stuff that will shatter paradigms is now just a Google search away. And it's sort of, what do you call it? On demand.
Yeah.
So what's been won and what's been lost and what you saw as your fight?
What's my role in this world? Like, I introduced this information that wasn't there before, and now it's everywhere. And there's
right, but I mean, does that mean that, you know, not unlike Downard's sort of Masonic prophecy that everything will become manifest, and that eventually, you know, truth will become irrelevant? So we seem to be in that.
Yeah, that's right. He's a genius, man. My God, he's so brilliant.
So what do we do now, Adam?
My role is curatorial.
Okay.
Solely. It's all out there. Not inventing stuff.
Uh-huh.
But putting it together.
Uh-huh.
Whatever. So it's... But there are things that are not done because the money people cannot get behind it.
Right.
For example, I'm putting out a book. It's going to the printer shortly. One's called Dying for the Truth.
Yeah.
There's a blog in Mexico called Blog del Narco.
Uh-huh.
It's about narco terrorism.
Uh-huh.
But what, you know, people know about it. It's a lot of killing going on down there. But people don't realize how much and what is really going on there. And this Blog del Narco tells you about it. But the incredible amount of murder And the murderers don't want to be not known. They want it to be known. So they arrange bodies and parts and things.
Mm-hmm.
They put all these messages on it. So they want to make sure that everybody knows who did it and when and where. And it's sort of like it's the end of Western culture, really. How is that manifesting in our culture? And what is
here?
Yeah. Is there news about it? What do you know about it? No one knows about it. But like mega murder stuff just within an inch of the border, you know. They hang loads of bodies, Ciudad Juarez and Tijuana area. It's incredible. And sort of like, so here's something I'm publishing that's not manifested in the everyday, but there's still that blindness and or not even intentional blindness because it doesn't sell things well, you know. That my role is to do things people won't do.
Right.
Not all the time, but just some of that. I feel that's my role. Yeah.
But when you look at American culture and what's being dumped into our heads on the TV, that, you know, when, you know, thematically what we're dealing with here is a malignant tabloid culture,
mm-hmm.
A sort of predatory reality TV culture,
mm-hmm.
Completely corrupt political culture, a sort of religious fanatic culture. So how do you take that in? I mean, like, you read the writing on the wall. I mean, that's part of being a curator. It's like, well, you know, I saw all this coming. And I know your job as a curator, but as an intellectual person, I mean, are we in some sort of aesthetic apocalypse, or are we in a real apocalypse?
Well, I'm not sure, but I'm, you know, not just biding my time. I moved up to Northern Washington State myself. I'm growing my own food and stuff. I mean, I'm inoculated with these apocalyptic concepts. It's hard for me to get outside of that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people think I'm just overreacting, I'm paranoid, and that very well may be.
Mm-hmm.
Probably is.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know.
You have kids?
No.
It's just you and, yeah, a wife up there?
I did have a wife, but she moved out back to L.A. because she couldn't stand being in this old hippie area.
Yeah. You know. Are you up there with some old hippies?
Yeah, I'm up there with old hippies. Yeah. But beyond that, think about eccentrics.
Yeah.
The eccentrics are revered, maybe, more so in England.
Yeah.
But they're ridiculed and cast aside in the United States, right?
Yeah.
Like, you can't be eccentric here.
Yeah.
Right?
It's like, yeah. Yeah, there's a momentum to maintain the status quo. And if you're eccentric and you're surrounded by, you know, 12 or 15 other people that are eccentric like you or trying to do you, then eventually some music label or fashion label will find the theme and then make it available to other people so they can appear.
And then take any, like...
Just gut the life out of it.
Exactly.
Yeah. So should I pack up and move?
Pack up and move to Port Townsend, Washington?
Yes.
Yeah, I want a good friend there besides me. No.
So the label is still there and still churning out books. I just got a big pile of books right under here that I haven't had time to get to, but I do have a pile in front of me. Is Rant still available?
No.
Okay. Manson File?
No.
Okay.
I mean, it's available. Yeah, it's available from Amazon as a print-on-demand book.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
This apocalypse culture will not ever be out again. The first one, which is the fucking classic.
That's still in print.
This one?
Oh, no, not that one. The revised
one. This one is like, I've protected this book. You know what I mean? It's like one of my...
Well, good. Well, yeah, that's a rare book now.
Is it? So what I've got in front of me is the Encyclopedia of Hell, an invasion manual for demons concerning the planet Earth and the human race which infests it. Okay. That's a new book.
Yeah.
What's this book about? Because I didn't get into it yet, but the what is it, I Hate Andy Kaufman book? Is that what it's called?
Yeah, the letters written to Andy Kaufman when he started insulting women. And
oh.
Yeah, he was having wrestling matches with them and so on.
Dear Andy Kaufman, I hate your books.
I hate your guts.
Your guts. Lexicon Devil, The Fast Times and Short Life of Darby Crash and the Germs. Hollywood's Hellfire Club, and then the big book that we discussed at the very beginning, right out of the gate, Ritual America, Secret Brotherhoods, and Their Influence on American Society.
It's a very visual book.
Yeah. And then there's the raw food book.
Yeah, raw food.
For my girlfriend.
Yeah, it's like a process.
Superfoods for super people.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a very cultic concept these days.
Yeah, raw foods is big. I just had a conversation about it. Are you doing that?
Sometimes. Not all the time. But if you don't do it all the time, then you're not doing it, right?
Yeah, you're just doing something to beat the shit out of yourself about the other time. Yeah, like, oh, fuck, I'm not doing it now. I'm an asshole.
I don't do that.
Do you butcher your own meat? What do you mean you grow your own food? You got animals up there?
No. Well, I got a dog. I don't eat my dog.
Good for you.
But the, grow kale and berries and potatoes and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
Beets.
Nice. Beets are good.
Garlic.
It's beet time now.
You can't beat them.
Yeah. So the Mason thing to you still resonates in terms of being a reasonable way to track the direction of power and of global domination and stuff.
I'm not sure. Maybe, but the global thing, all I can say is you can put together a lot of people who belong to the Masons, who then became very powerful people,
mm-hmm.
and then buildings
mm-hmm.
with Masonic cornerstones.
Sure, sure.
There are, you can't say this is not wholly important.
Sure.
Yeah.
Right. But what about the Trilateral Commission and about the G, what is it?
Bilderbergs?
The Bilderbergs, and then there's also the fucking Bohemian Club and all that shit. But I mean, right now it really comes down to banking blocks. When people say, they do this, they do that, there is a they meet once a year.
Mm-hmm.
At what is it, the G4, the G5, what is it?
G8.
The G8.
Yeah.
I mean, those are them.
Yeah.
It's right out there in the open. It's not Masonic.
No, it's not, the secret societies are not really that secret. That's a thing. They're
right.
All over the place. And so it's just a good old boy network stuff,
Sure. Right, exactly.
That's
it happens, and it's in the judiciary, it's in the political system, it's on every branch of government.
I agree, very agreed, but,
They run the big money laundering system that the dupes, who are most of us, just dump our fucking lives into.
I love the sinister aspect because it becomes very novelistic and very exciting when you do that.
What is that thing I got up there? There's a... Hold on a minute.
I think you'll like this. It's from this seemed to resonate with me. I think you'll like it. It's from Jim Harrison.
Uh-huh. Jim Harrison, the novelist.
Okay.
And it's one quote. The danger of civilization, of course, is that you will piss away your life on nonsense.
I don't call that a danger for me. I call that reality.
Thank you, Adam Parfrey, for hanging out.
Thank you.
That's our show. I know it was a spirited conversation between two people that are fascinated with the stuff, specific stuff, but I was thrilled to talk to Adam Parfrey, and I hope you enjoyed that. Go to WTFpod.com for all your WTF Pod needs. Get on the mailing list, kick in a few shekels. Check out the episode guide. Get the app. Get the premium app. Get the first 100 episodes on DVD. Check out the calendar. Go there. Leave a comment. The dicks weren't there last week, so I'm not trying to encourage them, but, maybe you can get in there and leave a comment without having to engage with some troll douchebag. All trolls are hacks. Same shit. Same hate. Same point of view. For a very specific purpose. To aggravate and feed off of other people. All right, look. Heavy-hearted, heavy-handed. Oh, shit, I forgot to tell you. I'll do it on Thursday. All right, I gotta go lose some weight right now. Boomer lives!